This podcast is one of the many good ones on the Self Defense Radio Network. Hi, folks. I'm Bob Main. Welcome to episode number 435 of the Handgun World podcast. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop, and I am just a practical, everyday Yankee with a gun, born in New York City, raised in Wisconsin. But you know, since 1993, most of my time, I've been living in Texas since 93, when I met my wife. So I'm kind of a transplanted Texan. And, you know, as they say, I'm a Yankee. I'm actually a damn Yankee because, you know what the difference is, don't you? Down here they say a Yankee comes to visit, but a damn Yankee comes to stay. So that's what I did. I came to stay in the great gun-friendly state of Texas. Okay, this episode is called, Is It Possible to Buy Skill? You know, a lot of people try to do that. Not just in shooting, pretty much in everything that they do in life. They want to buy skill. In other words, they want to buy hardware. They want to buy guns, doodads, gadgets, sights, all kinds of, you know, optics and fancy schmancy stuff to put on their gun to make themselves shoot better. Does that really work? I used to be one of those. Man, I remember. I wish I had all the money back that I spent when I first started shooting. You know, I took this up in 2005. I started shooting and mainly competition shooting back in 2005. And I wish I would have spent that money on training classes and ammunition rather than all the money I spent modifying and slicking up my guns, because it didn't help me very much. The payoff was not good enough. The payoff was a whole lot better when I went to somebody that could teach me what to do and how to do it. Speaking of that, I need to give you a review of Carl Wren's at KR Training, his Defensive 2 pistol class I took a few weeks ago. Defensive Pistol 2 with Carl Wren at KR Training. You can find a link in the show notes for that if you're interested, near the Austin, Texas area. I like it because he taught a couple of different ways to do after-action assessments, 360-degree after-action assessments. He teaches it a little bit differently than I've taught it in the past. It's good. It's good, and it has merit. And I think, you know, this is one of the reasons why I'm dedicating myself for the next year and a few months to doing nothing but training and improving myself, and then get back into instructing probably in 2019. I want to be able to better myself, and I think I'm doing that. Another good thing about the Defensive Pistol 2 class at KR Training, I got to go through the shoot house that he had there, which really is a huge lesson in decision making when you have a loaded gun in your hand, that I made some poor decisions. And better to make those poor decisions in a training class in a shoot house than it is in real life. In real life, you don't want to be making those poor decisions. So I want to do as much of that as I can. When I go to the tactical conference, the Rangemaster Tactical Conference next March, I'm going to go through the shoot house. Wow, that reminds me. I need to get signed up for that pretty soon. If you're going to go, sign up for it soon. They sell out several months in advance. It's March 2018. So that was fun. I got a chance to practice one-handed malfunction clearing. I know how to do it, but I got a chance to practice it. And I learned in that class how much of a plus it is to carry my spare magazines in the horizontal position. Huge plus, I think. Especially when you're clearing malfunctions. When you're clearing malfunctions one-handed. Let's say you put that gun between your knees and you hold it between your knees, right? And you need to get a spare magazine. You know, well, think about this. Let's say you're a right-handed shooter. And you either put that gun between your knees or you put it back in your holster, and you now need to get another magazine to reload that. You need to do it with your right hand only, because maybe your left hand is shot or it's cut, or a bad guy is, you know, holding on to it or something like that, and you can't use your left hand. If you're carrying your magazines behind your left hip, and you got to try to use your right hand to get those magazines, it's not easy. It's not easy. But if you're carrying your magazine horizontally, forward of the hip, near your belt buckle, and you use a good mag carrier like Mag Holders. Mag Holders are great, magholder.com. I have a couple that Dale Fricke also makes, a couple of horizontal mag carriers for my shield that Dale Fricke makes. Either one of those, they're very good. It's so much easier using my right hand to get the spare magazine when I'm carrying it forward of the hip in a horizontal position. And it conceals probably even better. Better than carrying them straight up and down. And I don't have to carry them inside the waistband. And it's, I think it conceals a whole lot better than carrying them on my hip. So consider that. Consider a horizontal mag carrier. In that class, I also split between shooting my Glock 19 with a red dot and my Glock 19 with iron sights. I did not notice any difference. I didn't notice any difference in speed. And since we were really close up, I didn't notice a whole lot of difference in accuracy. I think where the red dot really shines is in long distances, like beyond 15 yards. Then it really has a clear advantage. But close, 5 to 10 yards, like I said, I shot half the class with my red dot G19 and half the class with my iron-sighted G19 with Trijicon HD sights with an orange front. And I noticed about the same shooting performance for me. I can see the red dot a little clearer, though, because of my 56-year-old eyes and my glasses that I wear. The red dot's more clear. But I have been learning to shoot with blurry iron sights. And it's not that hard to do. The last thing I want to talk about in that class is I learned the importance when you're shooting one-handed to have that crush grip. Whether you're shooting left-handed or right-handed, it doesn't matter. When you're doing it one-handed, have that crush grip, a good grip on that gun. I mean, crush that thing. Because for one-handed shooting, that's especially important. It keeps the gun stable, and it just overall helps it be able to control recoil and be more accurate, okay? So that's what I wanted to talk about on that. Now, my show is sponsored by Concealment Solutions, and that's the holster that I used, Concealment Solutions Cobra, outside the waistband holster that I love. So check it out if you need a good holster, all Kydex. I like those. Jason does make the hybrid holsters. The Black Mamba CE is a very popular one. ConcealmentSolutions.com. Check them out. Handgun World gives you a 10% discount. Holsters are so important, ladies and gentlemen. They're please don't go cheap on a holster. It's so important, and I am a huge fan of all Kydex holsters whenever you can. All Kydex. I believe they have better retention. They hold their shape forever. They don't wear out. The finish of your gun as bad as a leather holster, believe it or not, wears down the finish of your gun worse than all Kydex. So check that out, concealmentsolutions.com. Jason will do whatever he needs to do to make you happy. And thank you to all of you who have been signing up for the Shooters Club that Ben Branham and I put together. We've got over 70 videos on there that are really good. If you want to support my show and support Ben's show, because we're not heavily laden with commercials. We are listener supported, and it's kind of like a little partnership that Ben and I put together several years ago. The Shooters Club, shootersclubmembers.com. Great videos to teach you what you need to know to practice, and you can learn some things from videos. They do not replace live training, but they're great learning experiences, and you can become a member and watch the exclusive videos for only $8 a month. Check it out, $8 a month, $75 a year if you want to save some money, on a yearly membership. Go to the Shooters Club page at handgunworld.com. On the way to Gun Rights Policy Conference a few weeks ago, you know, Ben Branham and I, we got together, we carpooled, we drove Ben's MSP mobile studio. Big old huge Chevy diesel pickup that he drives. That's his mobile studio. You know, my Handgun World mobile studio is a 2006 Toyota 4Runner now. I love that 4Runner. I got a great deal with just very low mileage. It only had 58,000 miles on it when I bought it. How about that? An 11-year-old vehicle with only 58,000 one owner miles. So I'm now the second owner. Just a great running vehicle. That's the Handgun World mobile studio, the 06 Toyota 4Runner. But we took the MSP mobile studio up to Dallas, and we had a conversation about, is it possible to buy skill? All right, folks. Well, for the interview segment here on this episode, I'm in Ben Branham's mobile studio. We are headed up to Gun Rights Policy Conference. It's the Thursday before the conference. And Ben, what's up, man?
Hey, yeah, my big Chevy truck. My studio, yay. It's louder, sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. We'll make do. It's a good rolling mobile studio, and the air conditioning is nice and cold, and we're in a big truck. We kind of feel like kings of the road in this thing, don't we?
I like driving my big truck. I know. It's horrible, but I enjoy it.
You know what I noticed when you drive this is people will yield to tonnage.
It's probably the smart thing to do.
When you start to move, people seem to kind of get out of the way, except for one that we just encountered about 15 minutes ago.
Yeah, only one guy that tried to run us off the road. What a genius.
In a little skateboard of a car.
Yeah, what was it, a Zion, one of those little boxes?
Uh-oh. Now we might have a listener that drives one of those that probably just turned this podcast off.
Well, it might be a cool car and it might work great, but when you set it next to the full-size 2500 diesel truck, extended bed, extended cab, it looks like about a quarter of the vehicle.
Well, anyway, we're excited to go up to Gun Rights Policy Conference in Dallas. We're really looking forward to it. Tomorrow we're going to have AmCon, which is a bunch of podcasters and media bloggers and everything for the firearms industry getting together and trying to figure out how to advance the cause more and, I guess, you know, grow our podcasts and make them better. So that's going to be all good for you, the listener. I'm ready to learn some good stuff from that. Are you?
Yeah, I'm thinking I'm going to learn more about networking. Because I just want to meet all these people. Because I listen to more podcasts than I create, that's for sure. I probably got 50 of them that I'm always listening to.
Yeah, me too.
So I can't wait to meet all these guys.
And I can't wait, once the Gun Rights Policy Conference starts, to start meeting a lot of my listeners. You know, I haven't been to, an industry show, I think, since 2011. 2011 was the last Gun Rights Policy Conference I went to. So, wow, it's been a long time. Been 6 years. So it's going to be good to meet a lot of listeners and other fellow podcasters as well.
Yeah, this is my first one. I'm excited. There should be lots of people that I know there already. Lots of people in the gun community I want to meet. I don't think Michael Bain is going to be there. I wanted to meet him, but Tom Gresham is going to be there. I'm definitely going to go up and bug the crap out of him because I just want to meet him. So if you know Tom, introduce me to Tom.
All right, we'll try to do that. Me too. I'd like to meet Tom. All right, so I wanted to talk about the title of this episode, Is It Possible to Buy Skill? And what I'm talking about is shooting skill. You know, I think a lot of people try to buy skill. What does that mean to you, Ben?
Yeah, everybody's looking for the new, better gear that's going to make them shoot faster, shoot better. You know, be the super duper hero guy that we always want to be, but you can't buy that kind of skill. You're going to have to earn it, and that includes spending money, but it comes down to you, the shooter. Can you make the gun do what you want it to do? So can you buy skill? Eh. And then the other half of the coin is, yes, you can. At some point in your skill level, you'll come to the point where buying better gear will make you a better shooter. And then you can go the other way, where I hope most of you are right now. Please buy decent gear. When you buy cheap, crappy gear, it really hinders your performance as a shooter. And yeah, if you buy a little better gear, it will make you perform way better, including carrying your gun every day like you should be. But when you buy a crappy holster with a crappy belt, and you buy a crappy gun that's not the right size gun for you, and you just stop carrying it. You know, you bought a Desert Eagle 44 Magnum to carry concealed.
Yeah.
So you just don't carry it. So there, you could buy a little bit of skill by buying, I don't know, a single stack 9mm shield or Glock and a decent holster and a decent belt and be carrying your gun every day.
Yeah, and so the question about can you buy skill, what you're saying works the opposite. You can also buy down your skill by buying terrible equipment.
Yeah, by going really cheap, you can really hinder your performance on stuff. I think that's, you were saying that before the show, is that, yeah, we've seen some people at classes and out on the range that really hinder themselves. They're fighting their gear the whole time. When they spent $10 on a holster, if they had spent $20 on a holster, they wouldn't be having any of those problems.
Yeah. Now, one thing I wanted to bring up, see what your topic is or what your thought is on this topic, Ben. I think here's one example of where maybe you could buy some skill, and that is sights. Let's talk about iron sights for a minute right now, not red dot sights, but sights. The first example that comes to my mind are Glock pistols. You know, Glock comes out of the box with terrible sights. And a lot of, especially new shooters that really don't know, they'll go to the range and they'll start shooting with those terrible sights, and they may do okay. But I bet if a person invested in a good quality sights with a good rear sight, with a wide enough notch to have enough daylight and on both sides of the front sight, and a thin enough front sight that doesn't cause a lot of glare and things like that, that's easy to pick up, well, that might maybe improve their shooting a little bit, don't you think?
It depends. If they got the fundamentals going first, then it'll help them.
Right.
If they don't have the fundamentals and they're still shooting low and left every other round, it's probably not going to help them.
But they don't have to be a professional-type shooter to benefit from an upgrade in sights, do they?
No, and then the other half is, where is your eyesight at?
Yeah.
If you're 20 years old and you're an Air Force fighter pilot, you know, you probably have the best vision ever. You have better than 20/20. Whatever sights you put on the gun, you'll be able to rock them no problem. If you're getting a little older, your eyes are getting a little better, you wear glasses and your prescription is changing all the time, so different sights, you'll be able to see them much better, much clearer, and those will improve your shooting a lot.
You just described me.
Yeah, he's old. He's half a century old.
More than half a century.
Which is good. But yeah, I'm finally at that point. I'm turning 40 this year, and I'm really starting to notice that's a problem.
Haha, you're 40.
Yes, and my vision is no longer 20/20. I used to have like 30/20 vision. Mine was way better than 20/20. I could read down that eye chart all the way down to like the copyright when I was doing those eye tests.
Wow.
Now, I'm like, with one eye, you know, one hand over your eye, I'm like squinting and trying to lean forward to see it. So I'm losing my 20/20 vision. I'm going to need glasses pretty quick.
But well,
I'm really to the point where I can see that, yeah, sometimes sights help me a lot, especially in picking them up, the three dots, and I really like the front dot, a dot on the front with a real thin blade,
right,
real big blade in the back, flat black, and as big as blade in the back that I can put on the gun.
Yeah, I just recently, it was about, I think, a year ago, I did two podcast episodes on eyesight. One of them I did on my own, the other I interviewed Grant Cunningham, and you'll find in most people that are my age, 56, you know, almost 60, maybe a little over 60, you'll find that certain things definitely work and certain definitely do not. Some sights definitely don't. It's a personal preference, but most people will find when you get eyes like mine, you have to wear glasses 80% of the time or corrective lenses, or even if you had LASIK surgery, you'd be amazed because that's not always perfect. There are certain sights that are going to help you shoot better, and there are some that are not, and maybe not even shooting better. But I tell you what, here's something I want to say about sights, especially let's talk about red dot sights. A lot of people think that red dot sights are going to buy them better skill. What I've noticed now in spending a considerable amount of time shooting a third gen Glock with a red dot, Trigicon red dot, I can't completely say that it has increased my skill, but it has not diminished my skill. And shooting seems to be a little less effort. Shooting the same seems to be a little bit less effort because I only have to focus on one thing, that's the red dot. And when I wear my glasses, that red dot is crystal clear.
The red dot, I think we go way past where we want to be. That's the one that we really argue on a pistol. Can I buy skill right there? Can I buy that $1,000 cut and dot and put it on there? And some people will say yes, some will say no. I will say unequivocally, no, you cannot put just a $1,000 dot on your gun. It'll make you a better shooter. Any piece of equipment you add to your carry or your gun or anything requires more training, not less, to make it work. And this is where law enforcement, military, just about any industry super mucks this up, thinking that, oh, we can just buy this doodad and it'll fix all of our problems for all of our people.
Yeah, people think that, yeah.
No, and that's every industry out there. You can think about whatever industry you work in.
Yeah, you're
and
right.
I'm sure your boss thinks that we can buy this little freaking doodad that'll make you a better worker.
Yeah.
And you're like, I don't want this stupid doodad because I don't want to learn how to use it, right?
Exactly.
So, yeah. And that red dot on top of your pistol is no different. And for me, it was the Glock I fight all the time. I wouldn't even bother for me putting a red dot on a Glock because I can't make this thing stupid thing work. It slows me down. It's not really improving my accuracy at long distances. It's just harder for me to work. And yes, if I totally sat down and dedicated myself like Bob has to do it 100,000 times, I could probably pick up my speed and be where I am and have a little bit better accuracy at long range. I found that was just a complete waste of time for me trying to do it. I'd rather take all that time and just keep making myself a better shooter. So if I'm going to do 100,000 draws from the holster to dry press, I'd rather do that and improve my skills where I am right now than just try to work that dot and figure out where I am. Because you'll hear people like Gabe Suarez and some other people that are really into that dot, and they're like, yeah, do it 100,000 times and your skill will be right there and it'll catch up. Well, I don't want to catch up my skill. I want to keep it moving forward. If I can't take a piece of gear and make it catch up to where my skill level is really fast to keep myself moving forward, and I want to talk speed and accuracy. That's the only two things that really matter, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, and reliability. But other than that, on your skill level is speed and accuracy. You got to be accurate, you got to be fast. That's all there is to it. There's not much else. So if it's not making me faster, if it's not making me more accurate, what is that piece of gear doing? So on the Glock, it's not helping me.
And like I said, for me, it's not, I can't say there's been a huge improvement, but being able to, it just seems that like it takes less effort. I don't have to work as hard to get my gun on target and be putting rounds where I want. I'm not going to say it makes me shoot faster. I don't know. I don't know how to put it. It just seems like there's a little bit less effort involved, but to each their own. Everybody's different.
Well, and then there is something to be said about that. I will take the speed and accuracy back. Effort is a big thing, too. For me, a Glock trigger sucks. I know you guys love Glocks, and they work great. But I really have to put a lot of effort to make that Glock trigger go smooth to the rear so I can make a good shot. Other guns, 1911s, even my M&P, SIGs, it takes me less effort on the trigger. So if you're running less effort to make the gun work, that means I can use more brain power during an incident to worry about bad guys and all the other things you got to do during a fight than just have to run the gun. So that could be a good thing too. So I love having these discussions with you, Bob. Make me see things a little different thing.
So all right, so you brought this subject up, so let's talk about it. Triggers. I think a trigger is probably the most common way that people try to buy skill. Everybody wants to buy the trigger that's going to make them shoot like a professional. And, you know, I got to say, I was one of those guys. When I first started shooting in 2005, 2006, one of the very first things I did was go to a gunsmith. I bought two real nice 1911s. And, you know, the two nice 1911s I bought, their triggers were just fine. I couldn't even dream of shooting the gun's potential, those 1911s. But I was stupid. I was caught up in all the gear race. I was caught up in trying to buy skill. And I paid gunsmiths several hundred dollars to, get this, improve the trigger on my 1911. Thinking, okay, I'm going to buy skill. And I think that's one of the biggest areas where people make the mistake, don't you think?
Yeah, we've all done it. If you've been around the shooting world for a while, I've done it. I've had custom trigger jobs. I've had my Glock polished. I've changed all the Glock internal parts. I put ghost triggers in. All of that crap, shut up and learn how to shoot your gun the way it is. How yeah. it comes out of the box. Once you can do that on the master level, like other people go, ooh, you're awesome shooter. You can make hits out past 100 yards. You can do it relatively quickly. You're looking at picking up a top-level shooter in IDPA or USPSA. Now we can start talking about maybe you can have the trigger worked on to have it smoothed out and stuff. If you're not that master-level shooter, you're wasting time, money, and effort trying to figure out how to make yourself better when really you just need to get the stupid thing out of the closet and start dry practicing it. Somebody told me that the 1,000-round trigger job works pretty well.
Some guy came up with a 1,000-round trigger job. In fact, I'm going to increase that to 2,000-round trigger job. You know, for so many years I said, you know, shoot your gun 1,000 times before you even make any single modification other than the sights. I'm going to say 2,000 because, you know, I shot guns a lot for 1,000 rounds, and yes, I got better, and wow, the trigger just magically got better. But boy, that 2,000 or 2,500 round mark, that's when it really kind of gets nice.
And I got my carry M&P that's probably got close to 8,000 rounds through it. That thing is a really, really nice trigger now.
I know, I've shot it.
It's better than most of the triggers out there. It's better than the Apex. It's better than the 2.0. And you know what I did? I pressed that trigger, and I probably dry practice about 10 times as much as I live fire. So I got almost 8,000 rounds through the gun. So I pressed that trigger close to 90,000 times. It wears in pretty good after that. And then you get pretty good at where that trigger is, how it sets, where it works. It's not for a while that you'll get to the point where the trigger can impede your progress. And that's really the only thing that you can get to. When you can really say that that trigger is giving you effort to make a better shot, and it's really starting to impede your progress. Even a Glock, I say it takes me more effort, but it doesn't impede me really. I shot one of those Maxim 9s, the suppressed pistols. Really cool gun. But that gun was so dirty or something that trigger and the reset wasn't working right, and I could feel it as I pulled the trigger to the rear. I could feel where the reset points were. There was two clicks for two resets, more like a revolver than an autoloader, and I could feel them as I pulled through the trigger to them.
Yeah.
And that really, and I don't know if it was really bad. It was more like having a two-stage trigger on a rifle, almost. That was three stages. It really didn't bother the last bit of the trigger pull. So it might have been just me that was having a problem with it. But to me, that really distracted me. If it's not distracting and you can't quantify it, you shouldn't do it. And when I say quantify it, you should be able to go out of the range, shoot your pistol for accuracy or speed, come up with something. Do a 5x5 drill at 20 yards. If you can do that, or you can't do it, let's do something crazy like that. 5x5 drills, a 5-inch circle, 5 shots in 5 seconds out of the holster, and normally it's done at 5 yards. That's pretty easy standard at 5 yards. Push it out to 10. If you can't do it with your pistol the way it is, and then you change the trigger and you don't do anything else and you go shoot it the next day, and then you can make that standard, well, now your trigger's helping you.
Yeah.
Most of us can't quantify our trigger like that. We can't come up with a test, do the test, and fail day one, have the trigger replaced or worked on, and then pass the test the next day. That's why I said it's not helping you. Unless you can do that, it's just not helping you.
Yeah. You know, just to kind of go backwards just a little bit, back when I recorded that episode on the 1,000-round trigger job, About 3 or 4 days later, a listener sent me an email, and he said, "Hey, Bob, you know, do you realize that 1,000 rounds of 9mm costs more than what I could pay a gunsmith to do the trigger job?" And I responded, I said, "Yeah, you know, financially, you're exactly right. But you won't get the shooting experience of 1,000 to 2,000 rounds, and so I don't believe you're going to get the complete benefit out of that trigger job until you, the man or woman behind the gun, the owner of that gun, pressing the trigger, till you get the experience." And by the way, I'm not just talking about going to the public shooting range, renting a shooting lane for an entire half a day, and blasting off 1,000 rounds into a piece of paper or cardboard targets all afternoon. I'm talking about 1,000 rounds of real training, or a couple thousand rounds. Then you probably notice the difference, right?
Yeah, that'll definitely make you better. You can't just go to the range and turn money into noise. You're not going to get any better that way. Got to go out with a plan. What am I going to work on? Am I going to work on speed, accuracy, up drills, whatever? Get the dot torture test if you want to work on accuracy. You think you're good, do a dot torture test at 3 yards. 3 yards. And see if you can score 100% on it. Go ahead, I dare you. Most of you at 3 yards can't do it. I know where my skill level is. It's at about 5 yards. I can do it 100%. And at 7, not so much.
Right.
So it falls off real fast. And so when you can do different guns and different tests like that, I just did one of those tests, by the way, Bob. Borrowed that Sig Romeo RX before the recall. All the mess. But I actually scored better shooting the guns side by side. I did the test with the Sig Romeo RX, and then I did the test with my carry gun. I scored 2 points higher at 7 yards with the Romeo than I did the carry gun.
Really?
So, yeah, I can actually quantify it, but it's only a little bit. I mean, I scored 42 or 43 out of 50, and then I scored like 45 out of 50. It was only a couple points, but it was a couple points higher, which really impressed me. I was like, wow, look, wait, I'm shooting better? So when I see that, I go, huh, maybe buying a little more gun there would actually make me a better shooter, because I can quantify it. I can look at them side by side and go, oh, I'm shooting a little better. Maybe it might be worth it then.
Well, you're at the level, I think, you know, you're not, you're far from even being an intermediate shooter. You're way, way, way even above that, you know. So I would say that, yeah, someone with your skill, you can benefit a little bit from maybe buying a few extra little things or a different type of a gun.
Well, and I have noticed, and this is going to sound funny, but I've shot a couple really nice 1911s that run $2,500 to $3,000. And I do shoot those a little faster and a little bit more accuracy with a little less effort than my M&P. I'm not sure it's worth the $3,000, the amount of performance enhancement I get.
Did you try those guns out of the holster?
Yeah, I actually got to run some of my classes out of holsters. I've got to run them at the range, just on the square range. And they, yeah, I would be all over a high cap 1911 STI, that they're 2011s actually, if I could afford it. But their base model that I'm looking at is $2,400 at the shop that I shot. And I was like, yeah, I can buy a lot of ammo, a lot of training, and a lot of fun for $2,400.
So even out of the holster to the first shot, you were faster with those than, like, your M&P?
I didn't get to do that. My splits were faster, and my accuracy was better. So coming out of the holster, I don't know. That's a timer and something that I haven't been able to play with.
I think that's the true test. I think the true test is out of the holster to the first one or two shots. If, you know, because that, I think we all pretty much know, in a ordinary civilian gunfight, that's probably what's going to matter the most. Out of the holster, get the first shot or two with good hits. You know, can you do that with the gun? And the reason I was asking is because for the time I've known you, Ben, I haven't seen you train a lot with a 1911 out of the holster. So I know you used to do it, but that's why I asked that question.
Yeah, I haven't been able to put that on a timer side by side. If anybody wants to loan me your super expensive 1911 9mm so I can run that test, I'll buy the same holster and go at it and see if it works or not. Yeah, I don't know if that's going to be faster. I know that my split times were a little faster, and my accuracy was a little bit better. Maybe it's just coming back to the 1911 because it fit me. Maybe it was, you know, 40, 50,000 rounds, and God knows how many hours over almost a decade of carrying one of those that I'm just coming back home. I don't know, but yeah, I can shoot that STI shot a little bit better, a little bit faster, and a little bit more accurate than my M&P does. But $2,500 gun versus $500 gun.
Exactly. Yeah. So, okay, another thing I wanted to talk about in terms of, you know, is it possible really to buy skill? A lot of people will also fool around with different types of levers on their gun. Sometimes they're extended slide release levers. Sometimes they're extended magazine buttons. Sometimes they'll either make the decocker, if they have one, smaller or larger, or they'll make the thumb safety smaller or larger. Do you think that kind of stuff makes much of a difference?
No. If we're talking just straight civilian self-defense, no.
Yeah.
Because we've talked about this multiple times on your show and my show. How many times have people reloaded in a civilian gunfight?
Let's see. That number would be about as close to zero without actually being zero. I guess there's some isolated cases, but, you know, as we think about this, as we think about the odds, what are the odds of you being in a gunfight in the first place? Very low. What are the odds of you, in an already low probability, being in a gunfight that's going to require a reload for more ammo to finish the fight? No, almost zero.
And I love to study gunfights, and I was jumping up and down about a year and a half ago, going, I found one in the civilian world where the guy needed to reload, and he wasn't carrying a reload like a knucklehead. So, base thing is, if you're going to carry the gun, you might as well carry the reload, because why not? If you need it, then you got it.
I'm not against carrying the reload. And you found one. And there might be more than one. Maybe there's a half a dozen cases out of all the civilian gun, you know, gun defensive gun uses where a reload was necessary. And again, we're not talking about the Miami-Dade shootout where the guys couldn't get their revolvers reloaded. We're talking about just ordinary civilians carrying a semi-automatic 940 or 45 pistol for self-defense. As I always say, learn to win the fight with your first magazine. Train to do that. Train to win the fight. Train that if you have a malfunction, a nasty one, that's because of a magazine malfunction, then train to get that magazine out, and you better have another mag.
Well, and I think it goes the other way. When you buy all these extended releases, extended buttons, you're asking for more problems. You're going to be fighting your gear. Because what happens when you lean on your gun wrong, and now that your magazine release sticks out too far, now that pops that magazine out the bottom, and you've got a one-shot gun if you have to go to it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, in my early days of shooting IDPA, I remember a stage. I had a Glock 34. I had a third-generation Glock 34. And if you remember, the third-generation Glock 34 is when you buy them and you take them out of the box, they already come with the older-style Glock extended mag release.
Yep.
Well, there was a stage where the gun had to be on a table. And so what did I do? I put the gun down on a table. I'm a right-handed shooter. So the left side of the gun, the side that the mag release was on, was laying down underneath, you know, it was laying down on the table. So it was the extended magazine, the gun's weight was on top of that mag release button. So the timer goes off, and I kind of slapped the gun by mistake when I grabbed it to pick it up. I kind of pushed down a little bit too hard. What do you think happened?
Magazine popped out.
Magazine popped out.
Yeah.
Magazine. So I picked the gun up, and I got one shot, and my magazine hits the ground because that magazine button extended out too much. Now, Glock has kind of changed that with the Glock Gen 4s. They don't do that, but that's an example where people don't always think it through.
And in the, you just look funny on the range during IDPA, and everybody laughs at you. In real life, that could cost you your life. So a lot of that stuff is just extra fluff that we're trying to, buy skill that thinks we can reload faster. I mean, what's the normal reload? So I can draw and fire my gun in about 1.3 seconds 1.2 open, 1.5 covered, depending on which gun, what holster, and all that good jazz. My reloads are still about 2.5 seconds.
Yeah.
So even if I put an extended button, extended release on their thing, the extended mag or slide release,
right?
Could I shave that from 2.5 seconds to 2.4 seconds? And would that matter in a gunfight?
Well, maybe you could shave it to 2.4 seconds, but I don't know how much it would matter.
Probably not. Here's where we get training scars from our competition world. From first to third on a lot of these competitions, 1/10 of a second is separating them. So that 1/10 of a second means a lot when I'm out there shooting an IDPA match. So I think that's kind of a training scar that we get from shooting competitions going, oh, we need to be faster and faster. And you look at that 1/10 of a second for first to third, that's over 5 or 6 stages and 40 rounds and 3 mag changes and 6 draws.
You know, you're bringing up a very good point, Ben, which as soon as you finish making this point, I want to expand on that.
So I think it's that training scar where we think that that 1/10 of a second or 500th of a second is really going to matter when proven again and again in real fights. It don't matter. It could take you 5 seconds to reload. You just got to keep reloading. I remember a study of a guy that was getting his butt kicked, a cop. He had a revolver. It went bad. A guy on PCP fights with 2 cops, one female, one male. The lady cop takes a round through the chest before they had body armor. She's dead right there. First round of the gunfight, she's all done. This guy ends up fighting with this guy on PCP, fires all 6 rounds in his revolver into him. Still can't get him to go down. He puts his head in the corner of the room. This guy is using his billy club to beat him in the head and the shoulders.
Oh, man.
As the cop is reloading all 6 rounds in his revolver. He gets all 6 rounds reloaded, turns around, and ends the fight with that next cylinder. It took him all day to reload when his hands were crushed and this guy is hitting him in the head. So do you think the 1/10 of a second would have mattered there or not? Or was it the will and the knowledge to make it happen?
And on that point, you brought up something very good. When you talk about the will and the knowledge, and I'm going to add to that, tactics. You know, what's going to be better, shaving off 1/10 of a second in time or learning better tactics? You know, back to this topic here of can you buy skill? A lot of people, like you just said a few moments ago, try to buy the skill and they save 1/4 of a second in the competition match. When they go shoot USPSA, oh yeah, I'm 1/4 of a second better now because I bought some kind of a piece of gear. I don't know if you had a chance, Ben, but if you listened to the latest episode of the Pro Arms podcast where Tim Ferriss talked about his gun store break-ins.
No, I missed that one somehow. I got to go back and find that.
Okay, the latest episode. I don't know what number it is, but it's about the Ferriss firearms break-ins, and Greg Ferriss. I'm sorry. I think I said Tim. Greg, the owner of Cedar Ridge Range. What he was talking about his tactics. He was talking about his tactics during the break-ins at his gunsmith shop, and yeah, you know, he was talking about how he was able to use better tactics than the knucklehead bad guys that were trying to break in. So anyway, his tactics won the day rather than maybe some widget or gadget that he put on his gun to save that 1/4 of a second at the competition match.
Yeah, and so I'll give you one, and I'm deficient in this right now because I'm having a brain fart. You guys carry a pocket revolver? I carry a pocket revolver all the time. Got one in my pocket right now. Which way does that cylinder turn? You know, Ruger's and Smith & Wesson's go the opposite way.
And yeah, they're different.
Yep, and then Ruger's brand new revolver, the plastic one that I carry, goes the opposite way of the normal Ruger. And for the life of me, I can't remember which way it is right now. So if you're in that situation where you got to reload your revolver, is that knowledge way more important than any gadget that you could buy to stick around in there?
Ah, good point.
So, yeah, you can buy $1,000 worth of gadgets and have USPSA race gear, but if you can only drop 1 round in your revolver to reload it, which way does that cylinder turn?
Yeah. And most people, when they're reloading a revolver, if they're using, you know, speed strips or whatever, if they're using, you know, fancy reloaders and everything for revolvers, unless they've trained with those, I've watched people, you know, kind of fuddle with it a little bit and goof the whole reload up because they hadn't trained with it. But they went out and they bought this, you know, fancy gadget.
I have a couple of those fancy gadgets for my little revolver. And
speed loaders.
Yeah, HKS or something. I think SK. Maybe it's SKS. I can't remember the speed
loader. Not SKS. I think it's HKS, something like that.
I can't remember the speed loader company, but they're real famous. They make really cheap ones. They're all over. They make one for every single revolver on Earth. It's awesome. But it doesn't really fit with the big Hope grip I have on my revolver. It doesn't really work. All the rounds don't fall in. And so no matter what I'm doing, I'm fighting it, and one of the rounds falling out or getting stuck, so I went to a speed strip. Why? Because I practiced, and I can't buy that kind of knowledge. If I had just bought the speed loader and gone, oh, I'm good, because this is easy. You just drop them all in there, turn the little doohickey, and they all fall in, you know, that would have, there's your gear hindering you again. So
exactly.
Now I carry a tough strip, and I can actually reload it faster with the tough strip. You know, two at a time over that stupid reload.
And I've seen you do that. I've seen you do that. You train for it, too.
Yes, I have a lot of dummy rounds, and I practice a lot with that because a revolver takes forever to reload.
Even reloading a semi-automatic, you know, magwells. Let's talk about magwells. You know, I've put magwells on some of my guns before, and I've also taken the magwells off of some of my guns before because I never really, for me anyway, maybe my skill level is not high enough. It never really seemed to help my reloads that much. I mean, there are some magwells that might add and shave that quarter of a second off, but if I'm in that situation where I'm in that rare situation, maybe I'm the second guy on the planet as a civilian ever to have to reload in a civilian gunfight, hopefully I am reloading behind some cover. So maybe I can take an extra half a second because there's no magwell on my Glock and seat that reload properly and get it in that gun.
Ugh. Magwells. That's, for me, on your double stack auto, your magwell is a face palm for me. What the heck were you thinking? What are you doing? You're buying gear for no reason that's just going to hinder you because crap's going to get in the way. Where the magwell came from is on 1911s with the single stack gun. So when you look at your 1911, a single-stack magazine, and a single-stack magwell, you had to line that thing up pretty well to get it in there.
Yeah, that's very narrow.
No funnel.
Right.
Well, now, if you're at home or where you can, pull your double-stack magazine out of it and look at it. What does that double-stack Glock, M&P, SIG mag do at the top?
It's tapered.
It's tapered a lot like a point, right? It comes up to the 9mm point.
Yep.
So it's kind of like its own funnel already. Yeah, your magwell on your Glock is overkill because your magazine has already got it made as part of the gun. So you're really not gaining anything unless you're that top-level shooter that has your magazine change, slide forward magazine change, when you're looking at a second or less. When you're pushing the second mark, okay, your magwell might help you. I told you my time is about 2.5 seconds. So, yeah, unless you're a professional level competition shooter, that magwell is a complete waste of money. Go buy some more ammo, buy some dummy rounds, and practice with it.
Unless you're shooting a single stack 1911, then a magwell is nice.
Yes, on a little single stack gun, a magwell is nice. But I'm carrying a single stack M&P shield right now. And that mag tapers at the top a little bit.
Yes, it does.
And I'm not going to put a magwell on that gun because then it will hinder it being hidden. I carry the single stack gun because I'm lazy and wearing a t-shirt and shorts right now, so I'm not carrying my full size gun because it's a double stack gun, it's fatter, and it shows underneath my t-shirt. The shield doesn't. So if I put a big magwell on there, it would kind of defeat the purpose, wouldn't it?
A little bit, yeah. So let's see, what are some other ways that people use to try to buy skill? Can you think of any others?
Always wanted to chase that unicorn, buy a better gun. Always going to buy the newest, freshest gun out there. Think the gun's going to make you shoot better.
Yeah, that's. I guess that's probably the... You know, we should have covered that first. That's probably the most common, right? Someone gets spends more money on a higher quality gun, and now, all of a sudden now, they're a better shooter. They're a championship-level shooter because they just went out and bought the same gun that a guy used last year to win the National USPSA Championship.
they bought a $600 Walther instead of a $500 Glock. Not gonna happen. Not gonna help you that much. Let me take that back. If you have a gun that's the wrong size for you, yes, buying a gun that is the correct size for you will help you. But that's about it. And some of the guns fit you better than others. And once you get a fighting, once you've trained enough to kind of get a fighting style and a shooting style in, now you'll start seeing which gun actually works for you. Is a SIG with the big fat grip and a double action, single action trigger, is that fit your style better? Or does a single stack 1911 fit your style better? Which one fits you better and which one fits your hand better and then your shooting style better? That's going to be up to you as you go. But most of the time, we're still talking, we're up there with that top level shooter again. If you're not a better shooter than I am, which I know there's some of you in the audience that are, kudos to you for taking the time, the training, the effort to be a better shooter. Amen. But if you're not a better shooter than me, you're chasing a unicorn that's just not going to help you.
Exactly. You know, I heard somebody say it, so I'm gonna borrow it from them. I think it might have been Mike Zeeklander that said that that said this on the American Warrior Show. I think that's probably where I heard it. He said, you know, take a Springfield XD and put it in Rob Leatham's hands, and then take a $3,500 Nighthawk and put it in your hands and compete against Rob Leatham. And one gun costs $500 and the other is $3,500. Who do you think wins?
Rob's still going to outshoot me in every way measurable. So, yeah, just you look at that stuff and, yeah, those guys, they spent the time for the skill. Spent that time. And that's what it comes down to, is time and effort. And sometimes effort does mean money. I got one more for you on the can you buy skill.
Okay, go ahead.
You can buy training classes.
Ooh,
and Bob and I are huge on that. Buy the ammo, buy the training classes, come out, train, and get better. But are you really buying the fighting skill when you go to the class? You go to a class, your shooting skill will jump up astronomically overnight. I mean, literally. You go to a class for the day, the next day, your shooting skills are, especially if you're a novice shooter, your shooting skills are 10 or 20 times what it was the day before. And that's awesome. But it's a diminishing skill. It goes away really, really fast. The only way you keep it is to practice it. And a lot of guys, even, I mean, there's some good shooters that I know that are, they're training buffs, and they will take every training class they can, and then they don't practice at home. So they go to the training class, their skill goes way up. A week later, their skill's coming back down to where it was. You know, 2 weeks later, a month later, they'll take another training class, their skill will go way up. They're not practicing doing the dry fire, their skill level goes way down. You got to put the time and the effort in, and that includes going to the training class, learning all those skills, and then continuing to practice them, dry fire and live fire. Nobody likes dry fire practice. It gets boring really fast, and it's an incredible amount of discipline to make yourself do it every day. But that's where you get good, and that's how I got good. I did it every day for years. And I'm back to that. I'm doing it like 4 or 5, 6 days a week. It's a little harder now with a family, I got to admit.
It was easier
when I was by myself.
It is.
But that's how I got good, was I did it every single day. And you go to a class, and then for the next week, you practice all of that stuff you learned in that class. And then you just go back to your dry fire regimen. It's the only way to get good. It's the only way to really be skilled. You buy a couple things to help you out, and then you got to put in the time.
You know, in the beginning of this interview, we were talking about, is it possible to buy skill? And we were talking about skill from a standpoint of, I guess, your quality of shooting. But skills also means tactics. Your tactics sometimes can be just as important as your skill level in shooting. Would you agree?
Yeah, and tactics are the thing that you got to put the time in for. Clearing a room is exceptionally complicated when it seems like it shouldn't be, and the only way to learn that is to get out there and do it. I can tell you how to do it on the radio, but you'll look like the Keystone Cops if you don't practice it. And I got news for you, everybody does. I have videos of it done right, and I have videos of it done wrong. And you just got to get out there and put in the time. That's how you gain the skill, is to put in the time.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, this was a good discussion. I think we might be able to have more to say about this, maybe on the way home from GRPC on Sunday. But there's a couple of other topics, too. I think we're going to record one for your show coming up pretty soon. And then, of course, while we're at the conference this weekend, we'll get some more interviews. So, Ben, thanks again for coming on and talking about this.
Hey, I love that you pick a great topic and we get to have a good conversation. And I hope everybody enjoyed it and learned something.
And for people who are new to listening, where can they find you on the internet?
ModernSelfProtection.com. You'll get the podcast, blog. I'm trying to start a YouTube channel, all that stuff. ModernSelfProtection.com.
The Modern Self Protection Podcast. Ben, thanks again. Appreciate it. Later.
Well, many thanks to Ben Branham. I had him, you know, locked in his truck, and I made him drive so that we could talk about all this stuff, and I could handle the recorder and all that fun stuff and throw my opinions in there, and I think you might have got something from that. I did. I tell you what, I got something from doing the interview, and then, of course, I've listened to it again before posting it up here on the podcast for you to listen to. Please keep sending over the audio files, those of you who want to guest host an episode while I'm on break during December and part of January. It's going to be good for me to kind of take a break, but you're going to have a lot of good content. There are a lot of people who have contributed some really good stuff, so I think you're going to really enjoy it. So check it out. Send me, if you want to send it to me, handgunworld@.com. Excuse me. Handgunworld, I'm sorry. Throat's giving me problems here. Handgunworld@gmail.com. Handgunworld@gmail.com. Try to keep it less than 30 minutes. Pick a topic that you like. Send it on over. I've already got two or three of them. And it's going to be good. Folks, you know, the reason I'm taking a break is I got to avoid burnout. I feel like I might be getting a little too close to burnout if I don't take a break and step away. I'm sure when I come back, I'm going to be all refreshed and pumped up and everything. And I need to think about some things, because one of the things that's concerned me about whether I should, you know, keep doing this long term is that I've been doing this for 8 full years. I've started my 9th year already doing this show. And I've done a lot of things. You know, God's blessed me with some great skills and blessed me with good listeners like you. I've helped people start their own podcasts. I've helped people fill training classes that they taught and made good money on. Yes, I've filled some of my own classes that I've taught. I have interviewed people that have written books and that had training classes and things to help them sell their books and help them become a little bit more popular. And I've done a lot for other people in the shooting community. I've done a whole lot for other people. And I don't regret it. I don't regret it at all. I feel like I have done more than what I've received back. But, you know, it's not all about what I receive. God loves a cheerful giver. And I'm a cheerful giver. And I have no regrets about anything I've done with the Handgun World podcast or today's survival show. No regrets. But now I'm wondering, how much do I want to keep giving? Because I don't get a lot back. I don't get asked to be interviewed very often. I've had a few shows that have asked me to come on. Not very many. After doing this for 8 years and becoming pretty popular, none of the major shows, podcasts, or radio hosts have ever asked me to come on. Maybe they think I'm too much of a competitor or something. I don't know. I don't get it. But I got to think about all this stuff. So please don't think that I'm being selfish. I'm not. Because all the giving I've done, I've even given away guns out of my personal collection to Shooters Club members. I've done that two or three times, given away guns out of my personal collection to members of our shooters club. So I need to kind of reevaluate the direction of the Handgun World podcast. I even helped start a network, the Self-Defense Radio Network, that helps a lot of people grow their audiences, but not much is coming my way from that. In fact, nothing. In fact, people, companies in this industry who decided to no longer sponsor the Self-Defense Radio Network now sponsor individual podcasts on the Self-Defense Radio Network. Thought that was interesting. So, I don't know what it is. And I can't put my finger on it, but I need to think. So it's going to be good taking a 6-week break. The middle of January is when I'm going to do regular shows from now to December 1st, and then take December 1st to about January 15th off. And in the middle of January, I'll be starting up Fast and Furious every week again, doing the Handgun World podcast, probably in a little bit of a different direction with a little bit different goals. And it's you the listener, are going to get the most benefit. Yeah, you the listener, you're going to get the most benefit. With all this in mind, I want to extend a huge thank you to you. Thank you for listening all these years. Thank you for the iTunes reviews that you give me. Thank you to all of you who are members of the Shooters Club. Thank you to all of you who have come to the classes that I have been a part of in teaching these classes. Thanks so much for everything, for all the support, and it's going to continue, and I'm looking forward to continuing it. So remember, if you want to bring out the best in people, you first have to see the best in people. And I'd like to remind you to read your Bible every day and shoot straight, shoot safe. I'll talk to you next week. Goodbye.